Brent, father. The snake coiled in tight loops of dusty patterns, like everything else in the scrub. My father killed it with a shovel, a swift strike right behind the head, faster than the snake. Another day, another snake, this time killed with half of a cinder block, thrown with all the force he could muster. It crushed the snake's head and sank deep into the sand of the pasture. "Get my gun," my father said. And I went to the back door, pulled the shotgun from next to the window, and took it to the back pasture. I handed it to my father and watched him shoot the head off another rattler. He carried the gun, barrel pointed down, back to the house. He slung his arm around my shoulders and shortened his stride so I could keep up.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
About a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 603 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I talk to Misty Watkins, who's the author of the new collection of flash memoir essays from Autofocus Press.
Hey, Rife.
The Drunken Odyssey returned from Miami Book Fair last Sunday. Many hundreds of authors made appearances there, and Samantha Nickerson, Chelsea Alice, and I interviewed more fair writers than the podcast has ever conducted before. But sweetly, I only interviewed 5 writers at the fair myself, though my interview with Walter Mosley did occur in partnership with the fair, so maybe that counts as 6. We have some excellent conversations to share with you in the very near future. I drove down Saturday morning from the secret headquarters of the Drunken Odyssey here in the greater Orlando area. This was my first time on site at Miami Book Fair since 2019, you know, before the COVID thing. Despite about a week of steady rain in Florida, the precipitation stayed glued inside the sky during the fair. Then, while recuperating on my return, last Wednesday I interviewed Felicia Day about her new audiobook, Third Eye. So that conversation is also in the pipeline. On December 5th, right before the Loose Lips reading series here in Orlando, at either Little Indies or Dirty Laundry behind Little Indies, but probably Little Indies, I will be reading rowdy poems from my poetry collection in progress in Buzo Veritas with a special guest, Amy Watkins. Hopefully I'll get video of that to share on the Drunken Odyssey's YouTube channel. More installments of In Buzo Veritas are likely to follow. Check this space in case I am still alive. I plan on road testing this poetry collection the way a comedian road tests an hour of material before a special. About 2 weeks from now, on Saturday, December 9th from noon to 3, Nick Gergadu and I will host another type-in at the Kerouac Project of Orlando. If you'd like to peck away on antique writing tools in the historic location where Jack Kerouac lived when On the Road came out and where he wrote the first scroll draft of The Dharma Bums, this is your chance. Bring a piece of writing you're working on, or just mess about with typography on the page. The latest installment of my flash fiction series, The Confessions of Guy Psycho, has just been published in Bachelor Pad magazine number 66. Should you want to purchase a copy of a retro pinup magazine, you know, for the articles, you can check out the link in this week's show notes. And if you're using Amazon for any Christmas shopping, you could do this show a solid and begin your Amazoning by clicking on the affiliate link in this week's show notes. Just go to thedrunkenodyssey.com and click on this episode's page. The podcast will earn a slight commission on anything you purchase with no additional cost to yourself. All right, let's talk to Misty.
And now, the interview of the day.
Right now, I'm in the secret headquarters with my longtime friend, Misty Watkins, who's the author of Hairwrath, a flash lyric essay collection about family bonds and the hard corners that absence can add to our characters. And the book has these little scientific asides about the environment, the fauna and flora of the Florida landscape as well. This might be one of the most Florida books I've ever read, and I mean that as a compliment as a student of that topic. So congrats on the publication, Misty.
Thank you. And I take that as a wonderful compliment that it's the most Florida book you've ever read.
And it's about the country in Florida, even though I grew up either redneck or redneck adjacent, but not in the country.
Yeah.
But I recognized, I mean, partly if you travel enough in Florida, okay, you get used to, like, this is a wild place.
Yeah. I think the first time I went to Disney World, I was 12 or 13. So my experience of Florida is very much centralized in the wilds of Florida.
Well, even in the early days of Disney, I remember in this like late 70s driving up because, man, I was so excited whenever we went. And in order to get to any of the parks, you're just driving through woods. And a lot of it's developed now. But in the 70s, no, it was mostly wilderness.
Yeah.
It's still mostly wilderness, but you don't drive by that part.
No, you can avoid all of that part now.
Not all of it, but a bunch of it. Yeah. There was that family from Nebraska who lost a child because they didn't realize the ponds may have alligators because it's a swamp.
And the alligators will find the ponds no matter what you do.
There's no absolute way to keep gators from... Just this week, there was a bear. They had to shut down the Magic Kingdom because a bear was roaming around Tom Sawyer Island. And then apparently it swam off the island and ended up behind the Haunted Mansion. But there were bear sightings and they had to shut down. And it's like... There's areas in Walt Disney World where the garbage cans are bear-proof. Like, they had to get special cans. And I remember thinking, I've never seen a bear at Disney World, but that doesn't mean they're not there.
That's a good point. I think that if you're going to go outside in Florida, you should just bear in mind.
There will be things that are alive.
Yeah. All of our wildlife is pretty good at adapting into, other than Florida panthers, the bears come into the cities, the bobcats do, the coyotes do. Alligators love any body of water and don't seem particularly bothered by our presence. So, you know, you got to keep your eyes
open. Gators don't give a fuck.
About anything. No.
They're not likely to mess with you. I mean, unless you step on them.
Even the otters. We have otters in Florida and they're really aggressive.
Well, got to be the right kind of otter to live in Florida. I think we're describing fun scenarios, Florida man scenarios, but this isn't what your book is about.
No.
And I've experienced your work before, which has tended to be more linear and more long form. So considering the way this book was put together in terms of a focus on family narratives in a way that is generalized with enough specificity so that it doesn't feel like warmed up nothing, there's a there, and sometimes there's a powerful there. But the country analogy I could use is this is like a quilt. There's so many different little pieces that come together. And I feel like as a totality, I've known you and your sister for years. And I feel like now I have all this secret information about your family that I've never had before.
Yeah, I love that metaphor of a quilt, honestly. I think that when I started to write them, what I thought a lot about were snapshots. And the way that you can sit with your grandparent and they show you these old family photos and stories emerge from those photos, but it's never an arc. There's never a full, you'll get the short story that is who your Uncle Buck was, and then you'll get another story that's about who his dad was, and you can piece together a family history that way. And so that is kind of what I have done in this book, or that's what I was hoping to do in this book.
Yeah, well, according to this one literary critic and scholar, you accomplished that.
Thank you.
And apparently at one point I gave you some really negative feedback on a piece, or I had a criticism.
It was not negative. I think it was really helpful.
Okay. I'm just saying, I've shown tough love in the past, so my saying this is a great book and I loved it. Hopefully, this isn't simply me hyping up a friend's work. Well, this is me acknowledging the greatness of a friend's work.
Thank you. I do appreciate that. I do know that if you had not liked it, I would have heard about that too, which is something that I really appreciate about you.
Well, you would have maybe not heard anything, or something gentle.
Yes.
So let's briefly talk about that advice I gave you, or the criticism I had, not because I want to dwell on it or because I want this to be about me, but rather, one, to make it go away as a topic. But what I remember is you said, oh, remember when you gave me that piece of advice about the walking piece? And I'm like, no, I have no recollection at all. And it turns out, I'm like, did I actually say that? I'm like, maybe I was kind of a dick.
No, not at all. Can I share what the advice was?
Please do.
Because I actually think it's really great advice. So I had given you this essay and you gave me a lot of really good advice just in general about structuring it, getting in earlier and getting to the good stuff. The part that was the harshest bit of criticism was you told me in your work, it sometimes feels like you walk right up to emotion, the real emotional heart of what you're trying to do. And you give us this glimpse of the emotion, and then you go, but don't look over there anymore, look over here. And that advice was hard to hear because I think, in all honesty, after years of therapy, yeah, that sums me up in a nutshell. That summed up my writing at the time. It summed up the way that I was living my life at the time. And it was really helpful because it made me realize there was something worthwhile about sharing those deeper vulnerabilities, that people could see that they existed. I wasn't fooling anyone. And so, again, personally and professionally, it was advice that I feel like I've applied in a lot of different areas. And it also made that essay immediately better.
So criticisms like that come from, okay, that's the most alive moment in the piece. And I feel like it was at the risk of being buried. And so very often when I have notes for people, it comes from me admiring a certain part of it and then realizing that it wasn't necessarily supported elsewhere.
Yeah. And I think that's the best kind of criticism, right? The best kind of criticism comes from a place of believing in what the author is actually trying to do. And if you can't see what they're working on or you don't care about what they're trying to do, any kind of critical feedback is going to feel really critical and probably not as useful. But if someone's giving you feedback and you believe that they see you as an artist and that they have something worthwhile to tell you, even harsh criticism can be really useful. Although I don't think your criticism was particularly harsh.
Okay. I had no recollection. It's almost a scandal how little I remember about the horrible things that I say on a regular basis.
Well, I can't help you with that one.
So it's almost like this book runs away from that advice and hops completely on top of that advice at the same time. The idea that you've got these flash essays, if we called them prose poems, I'm not sure I would feel differently about the book. Like there's more than one way you could successfully categorize what you're doing. But the lyric essays, it's really pointing at either the way that you connect or disconnect from family, or other family members connect and disconnect with one another.
Yeah.
So that it's a little oblique in terms of, okay, what is the grand narrative of Misty's life in Florida with her family? But on the other hand, it's almost nothing but emotional observations.
Yeah, they are all stories that have been told in the family pretty regularly. Some of them kind of behind closed doors, hushed moments. But yeah, there are stories that we've told. I think a good example of that is there's a story about my brother in it, and he was struck by lightning, and this becomes like a family myth about him. What I wanted to do was to kind of get down to what those stories mean for the individual and for my relationship with the individual, and how those stories really impact the way that other people see you and react to you, for good or for bad. A story, even a positive story, can become limiting in some way, especially when you don't allow for variation within the story. And so I wanted to play with that, and I wanted to see what it would look like to tell my version of the story, I guess, although that has a connotation.
But sometimes it's your version of the family version of a story. And I feel like there are times when you're probably trying to do the family story justice.
Yeah, my family is chock full of storytellers. They are delightful in that way. And so there are things that I trying to capture, like my dad's voice is always fun. He has such funny turns of phrases and things. And I really wanted you to see that and hear that on the page.
This family seems to have such strength in its own sense of family, even when you point out the frayed edges and the flaws.
Yeah, I believe so. I am proud of the family that I came from. I don't think that I would be who I am or where I am without them. I also just don't think that you do anyone any favors by not admitting that there are some frayed edges, that things are tough sometimes and things are not neat. The idea of like a perfect family portrait has never been particularly interesting to me. My daughter tells the story that we went on vacation when she was about 3 years old, and it was a beautiful vacation, but she had these moments where she would just burst into tears. And I took pictures of them, mostly because I thought they were funny. There's nothing funnier than a child crying while holding an ice cream cone and like a stuffed animal that they just got at the zoo. That juxtaposition will always amuse me. But we were looking through.
That also might be a way to condition a child to stop crying is, Mom is going to get the camera out if you start crying again.
Let me take this picture. But no, it's also, I will say, I think in the story, in the book, it's probably clear that displaying emotion is not something that my family is always good at. And one of the things that in this circular roundabout way, I think is really interesting is I've tried to give my daughter that ability to display her emotions. And now, whenever she is reading a book that feels really overwhelming or beautiful to her, if she is watching a movie and she starts crying, she takes a selfie and sends it to me. So I have this whole collection of my kid crying photos.
That sounds like a gallery show waiting to happen.
Oh, when she graduates from high school, I think I'm going to get a page in the yearbook. And instead of being like, I'm so proud of you, it's going to be like, look at this crybaby. And it's going to be all of the photos of her crying.
That sounds harsh.
She actually loves this idea. It's a joke. Okay. I'm not going to do this, but I do think there's something.
Well, if she's for it, I say do it.
Yeah. She's got a sick sense of humor. So
jokes about ideas of what you could do are most funny when you follow through and do them.
And that's true, too.
So here's a question I don't like to ask because it seems like a lazy question. How did this book come together? Because kind of like a quilt doesn't happen because you imagine, okay, now I'll organize the quilt. That's not how quilts come together. Part of the idea is also, if someone just hands you a bunch of squares, I guess you could go, oh yeah, no, I see how that comes together. But normally it's, no, you have to collect all the different little pieces and then figure out, what does this add up to? And in the case of this book, I wonder at what point did you feel the pieces joining into a larger thing? Because it doesn't feel fragmentary. It feels all the flash essays feel like very complete objects, but also as a book, the pieces build on each other and you start remembering, okay, you label each piece by which family member it is and identifying the family member. And I love the one where you say, Misty, sister, and then you write me.
Yeah.
To remind us, by the way, this one has the author in it.
Man, why do you think that's a lazy question?
It borders on asking, where did the idea of the book come from? Or how did this book... Someone who hasn't read the book could ask that question.
Okay.
Which is why I feel the need to talk about why I find it interesting and surprising and why I'm actually genuinely curious about at what point did these little pieces, which may have just come to you, at what point did it become a project where you could see, oh, this is building towards something cohesive?
So I love this question, and it's going to be a long answer because it went through so many different stages. So this started because I had a friend who wanted to write more. And so she was like, we're going to do a thing where everyone's going to draw two pieces of paper out of a hat, and you're going to get two genres, and you're going to write a story around those two genres. And I pulled out memoir and myth, which is what this book was called for a very long time. And so I wrote the story about my grandmother growing African violets. And I liked it, and it sat on my desk, and I didn't know what to do with it because it's very short. It felt incomplete to me. And then a few months later, there was Orlando Literary Reading Series called Literocalypse. And I was reading at Literocalypse, and I decided I was going to write a few more of these because I had a few ideas rattling in my head. And people really loved them. So I wrote a few more because I had a few more of these short things rattling in my head. And eventually I put them together. I kind of smushed them and fictionalized them a little bit more. And that was published as a short story by Borough Press in Fantastic Floridas. And then I went back to
They only publish the best people like me and you.
Right? Agreed. But then I went back to the real ones and I kept writing them. And I had about 15 to 20, I think. And I sent it to my sister, who is an incredible poet. And I was like, I can't quit writing these portraits of our family. I also have no idea what they are. And my sister, again, a beautiful poet, read them and she emailed me back and she was like, well, if you wrote 20 more, you'd have a chapbook. And I went, I could write 20 more. I have 20 more of these in my head.
My head won't stop writing them, so.
Yeah.
Probably.
And so then I did that and I wrote actually a lot more and ended up getting a full-length collection. Again, it's been referred to as prose poetry, lyric essays, flash fiction. I really wanted them to build on one another. So when you said that they did that for you, thank you. That makes me very happy. I wanted each of them to be greater than the last one because you had read the last piece. And I spent a lot of time thinking about the short pieces that are interspersed that are just about Florida. And so for me, the book came together almost in these series of fits and starts. And, you know, I should have been writing essays and I should have been trying to have things published, but I just kept wanting to go back to these stories about my family and these stories that feel both larger than life in my mind and also small and intimate. And I hope they're lovely.
Well, some of them are quite lovely.
Some of them are horrifying.
And where did the asides come from? The observations about Florida landscape and the critters?
I don't think you can grow up in the middle of nowhere, Central Florida, without having it impact you. And I grew up, it wasn't a working farm, but we had farm animals. We grew a lot of food. We were surrounded by people who grew almost all of their food. My dad took me horseback riding every weekend.
That sounds like a farm.
Yeah.
Maybe not an industrial farm, but a farm.
Yeah. And we were surrounded by the landscape in a way that is really impactful. For instance, I was born in 1986. I'm 37. We didn't have air conditioning in my house that I grew up in until I was 14, I think. And so again, even within Floridian childhoods, there are aspects of it where the outside was part of the inside and the mm-hmm. inside was part of the outside. And
even with air conditioning, that's kind mm-hmm. of a thing we have to keep learning.
Yeah, you can't avoid it.
I drove to Massachusetts for a weekend once. When I came back, there was a dead snake in the house that the cat had killed.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Not a big snake. I don't think a big snake could figure out how to squeeze its way in, but a little snake could. And I had to create a whole narrative because I'm like, this cat is such a coward. It would toy with bugs, but it wouldn't eat them. And it's like, how long was she dealing with the snake before she decided, oh, I better kill this because it's still here.
Yeah, that poor cat. I feel for it.
My current cat, it would take him 3 minutes to decide to kill the snake.
And then he'd be sad because he no longer had a toy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he would still toy with it, but actually it would probably take him 5 seconds, but then 3 minutes to actually follow through.
Yeah.
Anyway, big long digression. But yeah, when you live in the country without air conditioning and all the ceiling and all that, yeah, the outside and the inside, it's a less strict boundary than we would want.
It is permeable at best. But it did. It felt like there was something missing. And so I tried this. One of my favorite books is In Our Time by Ernest Hemingway. And he begins each of the short stories in that collection with these very short, usually about 25 to 50 words. And they're vignettes about the war. And it's interesting because for most of that collection, he doesn't talk about the war in the short stories. But the short stories become prefaced with this imagery of violence that really changes the way I read them.
This kind of journalistic.
Yes.
Dry, not bad writing, but dry voice.
Yes, and very different than the stories. But I thought when I read In Our Time, incredibly influential to how you should read those stories. And what I realized is
otherwise, why are they there?
Yeah, why would they be there? And so in my book, I didn't want a Florida scene at the beginning of each of these pieces, but I did feel like having them kind of scattered throughout can remind you that this environment and this family are coexisting in some way. And it's a way, in some ways, a way to look at some of the brutality a little bit sideways, mm-hmm. a central part of the story and kind of the event that everything else wraps around is the fact that my sister died and she was struck by a car. It was violent and horrifying. And that accident is not easy to talk about. And her death is not easy to talk about. And plenty of people in the family don't talk about it. And so in some ways, there are these moments of true sadness, and again, I can't think of a better word than brutality, that existed in my childhood. And that's hard to talk about when you're talking about a person who you love and who loves you. And so some of those harder scenes and emotions, it's easier to talk about what the bobcat does, or the fact that Brazilian pepper trees take over everything. And so that kind of became a way for me to look at, again, some of those harder emotions, and then also give you, hopefully, a grounding in a real place.
So to go back to the Hemingway, for most or all of the book, it's been quite some time since I've read it, but Nick Adams has Shell Shock.
Yes.
And you cannot depict Shell Shock by saying, well, in step one, you could do that, and you might medically understand what the phenomenon is, but that doesn't touch what it feels like at all.
No.
So to try and represent it narratively means not representing it, or representing it sideways.
Yeah, and I think the sideways is, I think it's how a lot of us come at really heavy things. And I don't think you can overlook the importance of concrete detail in your writing. And I tried to imbue each of the portraits of the family with some of these concrete details. But I'm talking about people and personalities. And I felt like when I was writing the book, sometimes I was getting a little far afield from that firm setting and grounding. Mm-hmm. And so these pieces allowed me to find my way back to that.
It teaches me about Florida's environment and makes me think of what it feels like to live in it. You've got this great description of the air, and it's like you have to swim through it, kind of, which, yeah, 5-6 months out of the year, that's what it's like.
It's a presence, man. A heavy one.
So as a teenager, I worked at a summer camp, 5 weeks without much air conditioning, and something went wrong with my brain. Just living in that environment, my behavior got a little too exuberant.
I can imagine.
One of my friends had a bow and arrow, and he was walking across the field. He pretended to shoot me, and I pretended to get shot. And then he runs over and starts doing CPR. And the problem is he's counting the counting, which one of the reasons why you count out loud is it signals to other people something is up. And then someone came running thinking,
oh no,
that had actually happened. And he was pissed. And I looked up thinking, oh yeah, we're assholes here. We took a joke that was funny for like 3 seconds, dragged it out to 2 minutes so that someone got triggered into having an emergency response.
Yeah, took it too far.
When you can't have a summer camp without having actual emergencies, you hope you keep them to a minimum, but maybe not something to joke about.
We all have to learn that at some point, I think. The understanding that, oh no, this is triggering something in someone else that I don't have the same response to.
Yeah, I was 18. I would have hoped I would have known better, but apparently, well, one thing I've learned is I'm never too old to be dumb about something.
No one is. There's always something more to learn, especially about how you interact with other people, right? That's a hard one.
So Stacy, your sister who was killed, comes up a couple of times. It doesn't come up throughout. And what I like about that approach, and if this were a long form essay, I might say, okay, you're avoiding the revelation, but there's no way to quantify what effect this had on your family. So the linear essay, the very fact of being a linear essay almost promises to deliver something like a quantitative definition of what that loss means. And there's a place where you indicate how it made your sister more like your sister. It's up to the reader to think, okay, what are the echoes of this loss? How is that affecting everybody else? And every person is a mystery, no matter how well we know them. So there's no way to quantify it. So I think it lets loss exist for the reader without letting us draw easy conclusions.
I feel like you're making me sound so much smarter than I am, but hopefully.
Oh no, that's exactly as smart as you are. But I believe what you're referring to, let me mansplain here.
Please do.
If you had to think of all that and try to accomplish all that, well then, yeah, you would probably fail. But just trying to be honest and get the ideas on the page without planning to do that, like as a strategy, I could see how that would be a very tall order, is to try and imagine emotionally, intellectually what you want to accomplish and then doing it.
Yeah, you're right. I think you kind of see what you were working through when you have the finished project. And then it's your job to go back in and revise for whatever you saw. Mm-hmm. But I will say that one of the reasons that there aren't a lot of conclusions that I draw for others is just that I'm writing about real people. And I can tell you a lot of what I see from my brother. I can tell you a lot of what I see from my parents and how they navigated that. But the conclusions that they actually draw, the ways in which that deep down has affected them, are their stories. It seems hypocritical to say I don't get to tell their stories since I literally wrote a book telling their stories.
But in telling those stories, you also try and respect boundaries.
Yes.
Not 100%, but to a reasonable degree, I would argue.
Well, yeah, I wanted the book to hint at if there's a journey in it, it is mine. It is all encompassing. And I think that's something that we get wrong about grief a lot, is we want grief to be contained and we want it to follow a really specific path. And it just doesn't. And yeah, it pops up in all of these different places sometimes, and it affects people differently, and people deal with it very differently. And I did. I wanted to hint at all of those things, and I wanted you to feel all of those things. I think one aspect of that is that the pieces themselves don't take up the whole page. There's a lot of space in the book. This sounds really silly, but one of the things that I like about that is that around all of these stories are real lives being lived and emotions that I don't have any access to. And so there is just a lot of empty space when you're talking about connections between people and trying to understand people.
And sometimes getting exposed to people's hangups.
Yeah.
Oh, this person has been thinking about this for years. And I didn't even know that was a thought, but that's a thought that that person has been having for years.
Exactly. And again, positively and negatively, right? You don't remember the advice you gave me, but that was really important to me. I was able to do something really important because you gave me that piece of advice. And sometimes I made a flippant comment and this person carried it around for a decade feeling badly because of my flippant comment that I don't remember. And that kind of interaction, those kinds of stories are interesting to me.
Well, your brain is a chamber of snark, so...
That is accurate. The sarcasm and snark run very deep.
But I think a lot of that comes from your earnestness. I'm Gen X, so snark and cynicism, and it's 99% of my brain.
Yeah.
So your frustration with the pretensions of the world and with the idiotic optimism, which is not to be confused with legitimate optimism, but so much of our culture is based on selling, and another word for it might be brainwashing, that being a person who grew up in the country who can keep her own counsel means there has to be this wall of defense up against the bullshit. And the bullshit is what mostly makes America go, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I feel I'm an educator and I feel like I'm patient in that way, that if someone is asking questions, if someone needs some help, I'm very willing to jump in and do those things. I don't like hypocrisy. I find the bullshit that makes America run very draining. And yeah, and so I would rather laugh about those things and point at them than punch through drywall, which is sometimes my immediate reaction.
You can punch through drywall?
No, of course not. I'd break my hand. Drywall isn't that hard, though.
No, I've never tried it.
Me neither.
I mean, I've thrown a few things that busted some drywall.
I've never punched through drywall.
As a child, now I remember, I struck out in kickball, which is almost impossible, but I struck out and then I punched an iron piece of something really hard. And I'm like, all right, I need to find new outlets for anger because I won't be doing that again.
I'm very glad you learned that lesson. That could not have been a good time. But no, I think I take that frustration that I feel, I put it into humor pretty regularly, which I think is where the deep wellspring of snark comes from. Because at the end of the day, I do think it is better to laugh and point out the hypocrisies, hopefully with some level of genuine kindness.
Well, it helps our patience, I imagine.
Yeah.
That we don't invest in the stupidities of the world, and therefore the responsibility of fixing it is not on us. When we have a chance, we'll do our part. And we will do our part happily, but we're not surprised when things don't get better.
I'm never surprised when things fall apart. Not ever. And I will say, if we're talking just kind of worldviews, and by that I don't mean politics, but the ways that we approach living. At my heart, I'm a pragmatist. And so I think we can rage against the fact that things die and people die. That doesn't keep them from dying, and it doesn't keep bad things from happening. And so more than anything in my life, I want to find ways to support others when they are going through these things that are really hard. But what I've found is very few people who are going through hard things want the gentle cliches. Very few people want the euphemism of, I heard someone passed. We want to clean up all of the hard edges and make it look nice. You go to a funeral and you're at the graveside and you have a mound of dirt that will be put over this body, and you've covered it with green carpeting. And to me, that hypocrisy makes the death so much harder to bear than someone wailing at the side of the grave or someone.
You've just given me an idea. I need to put some money aside for my estate because I want to hire 5 stand-up comedians who will roast me at my funeral. That's all I want.
I'm in.
And then booze.
I'm in. I'll roast you, John, at your funeral. I'll do it for free. Your all estate right. doesn't even have to pay.
Yeah, and you wouldn't even have to imagine what my flaws are because I think you know.
At least one or two.
There's one of the essays where ladies at church say something and then they, okay, and then we set our, and then they just start icing your family out. And now we're cauterizing the social wound so that we don't have to deal with it.
Yeah. And that one is very, each of the stories is based in fact, is based in a real thing that happened, but it uses this idea.
Including the genies.
Especially the genies. It uses this idea of myth, both familial and kind of cultural myths, to tell stories and get to the truth. So obviously, no women at church called my cousin an actual changeling. But yeah, there was a lot of social pressure to appear as if we had moved past some of these hardships and some of these things that the family was dealing with, which just added a new and different level of hardship.
Well, it creates a social hardship.
Yeah. And
it took something awkward and then made it really awkward.
And created a real sense of isolation for people who were struggling.
Yeah. How about you bring them food and then say, I'm here if you want to talk. And if not, I'll get the fuck out. Here's
yeah.
some food.
And that happened too. I don't want to paint a picture that is inaccurate. There were lovely women in that church and lovely women in most churches, I'm sure. But I will say that something that I think the book hints at is that religion is maybe not quite the boon that some people want to tell you it is.
It's not automatic. It's something you have to buy into.
Yeah.
And if you're a child, you haven't bought into anything.
No, I was a skeptical child, so.
Oh no, Jesus Christ existed and the Christian God is the Christian God and he exists. And it's like, okay, and Batman's real and the Lone Ranger's real and Chewbacca's real. And it's like, okay, no, those are fake. Those are imaginary, but what's happening in church is real. And my child brain is like, that's not adding up.
Interesting point of fact, I did not believe in Santa Claus. My family did not participate in the idea of Santa Claus because my mother did not want to confuse us because Santa Claus sounds a lot like Jesus. And she wanted us to have a deep and abiding faith and relationship with this imaginary person. And so we didn't do...
Or a real person, but with all of this mythological
yes.
stuff attached.
Yes. And so she did not want to confuse us. And so we did not participate in that.
I think that's admirable. I don't know that I would want it for my own family, but I think that is, among other things, that is a thoughtful person living life according to an actual ethical code that she has critiqued.
Yes, very much so. Again, you can say a lot of things about my mom, but one of the things you have to say about her is that she is kind through and through and very thoughtful in every aspect of her life. She thinks a lot about her actions and how they will be perceived. She thinks a lot about why she wants to live the way that she does. That's very remarkable to me. And I feel very blessed that I learned from her in that way.
Yeah, I find some Christians, I really do want to learn more about their faith. Not because I'm a seeker going, give me a way in. I think I would be the worst if you let me in. But
what do you even mean by that, John?
This has led to conflict in my life, actually. I don't know the Bible that well, although I know it. You can't be an intellectual and not have scraped by a bunch of it if you live in America. That's kind of a given.
Yeah.
I take it seriously, and I don't want to cherry pick to create a Christianity that is made to fit my soul the way I see my soul. E.E. Cummings refers to the Cambridge ladies who lived in furnished souls. Okay, that's an off-the-rack form of Christianity. And so people who feel like they have a personal relationship to God, like it's a personal God, I could be snarky about religion, but I'm not snarky about that.
No.
It's more the posturing. It's more the legislation.
Yes. I think there's a big difference when we're talking about macro versus micro, or religion as a system versus the individuals who have faith.
And who engage with that faith and think about it.
Yeah. And are motivated to change their attitudes and their actions based on that faith. Again, I said this, I think, probably 7 times already, sometimes for a positive and sometimes not quite so positively. But there is a difference between people who are thoughtful, again, and really searching in any way. I like a curious person. And I think that there are religious people who are curious and deeply influenced by the things that they discover. And they're approaching their lives with a great deal of compassion to other people and compassion to themselves, hopefully. And my mom was a really good mentor and example in that way. Again, I don't follow in her religious footsteps, but I hope that I have been able to emulate some of the ways that she approaches the world and the people in the world.
Your sense of ethics.
Yes. Although I got my dad's sense of snark. So again, it's this, it's not balanced, but hopefully it makes me a fun dinner companion.
So I thought a little bit about David Sedaris in reading your collection, not because your writing sounds or feels like his. It doesn't. You're both are excellent and you're both very different. But a lot of his essays are about his family. And one of the oddities of being a David Sedaris fan for so long is I know his family. I've never met anyone in his family. I briefly met him for 3 minutes. Or an hour and 3 minutes if we count my telephone interview with him. But it's this odd thing where his family is this public commodity. And that's just the way his writing evolved, where they kind of became more and more characters. And I think he said he lets his family vet his story so that if he is writing about them and they want to veto something, that they can. I wonder how you feel about memoir and your mom's name is Kim, and I know that, and I've never met your mom, and I don't know how much of your family I've met, but I feel like some of them are now characters inside my head.
Yeah. Oh, man. That is one that I struggled with a lot because I feel like the stories in this book are mine. And by that, I mean, if my cousin Justin didn't like the way that I talked about him swimming me across the lake, I probably would have left it in the book anyway. One thing that I hope people who read the book feel and see is that these are individual stories about complex people. And so you see the way that I felt about my cousins in this moment in our lives, and the way that I felt about my aunts and uncles when I was a child. And yeah, it is. You get to hear about my dad, right? You get to see him on the page and interact with him in the way that you interact with characters. But that is different than knowing someone. And that became this question for me. You'll notice that most of the people repeat. Pretty much everyone is mentioned more than once. And that was really important to me because I wanted there to be, at least in format, an understanding that there are different aspects and different...
These are glimpses.
Yes. Very short portraits. Glimpses. And that if you think about them like pictures, sometimes you have a really unflattering picture. And that doesn't mean that you are an ugly person. Sometimes you behave really poorly. There's bad behavior in this book.
Not a ton. Let's not oversell that.
Most of it's just implied. But there is bad behavior in the book, but those behaviors are not the only thing to know about these people. And I wasn't sure how to balance that. And it's still something that I'm not sure if I got the proper balance. But I hope that it's at least clear that I was thinking about it.
Well, and I'm okay with people not letting their families vet their work. Among other things, that would force me to force my family to read what I write. And that already seems like a non-starter.
Well, that's the other part. I have many a member of my family that, again, not because they don't want to support me, but just this book is marketed as prose poetry and lyrical essays, and that's not a thing that a lot of people are running out to the store to find.
Oh, I'm flying to Detroit. Let me just pick it up at the airport. That's not
going
to be at the airport.
No, it's not.
I'm trying to imagine a really hip airport, but I can't.
Maybe
nothing
the
happens.
One in Portland.
Yeah, that one. Not memorable.
No, not at all.
It's the least hip place in Portland.
Maybe that's why I liked it. I'm just kidding. I love Portland, but this isn't a book that you're going to pass to your, well, maybe depending on who your aunt is, you might pass it to them. But I do think that it's not fiction and it's not a traditional memoir in the sense that people often think of those. I love Mary Carr is one of my favorite writers. Mm-hmm. I think she is so incredible. This isn't like Liar's Club.
How so?
Well, in the sense that that story's formatting and kind of narrative arc is very apparent. And again, I think a lot of people who read fiction and a lot of people who read traditional memoirs are looking for a slightly more straightforward arc of a story. And this one, you're doing a lot of that work.
There's no arc.
No, not even a little bit.
I suppose you could impose one, or I think the pieces grow, and I do think they resonate with one another. All the pieces are great, but the sum is greater than the parts. But it reads more like a book of poetry than a straightforward memoir where, all right, this is the theme of the memoir. And so I will lead you to the end of my alcoholic journey.
Yeah.
And when we get there, I will be in recovery, but I won't be a currently active alcoholic in the alcoholic business. I just made that up.
Well, I think that there is something right. Again, a good poetry collection, I do believe, should build on itself. You should be able to see the ways that the individual poems create a greater sense in some way. But...
Well, so most poetry books are just, here's my latest stuff, that's good, which is fine. But those are not the poetry books where I think, oh, I need to bring a great poetry book with me on this trip. Just one, but let me say, and it's like, no, the ones that do have a thematic thread, those are the books of poetry that feel special as books of poetry. Like, I can remember this. Denise Duhamel has a book of poems. I think it's called Kinky. And every poem is about Barbie.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's fucked up and gloriously bizarre. It's not straight, you know, like, oh, like it's not a simplistic take on Barbie. And so it's like, but Barbie has all of these different guises, right?
Yes.
That's how you sell the outfits. That's how you sell new Barbie dolls, is you keep coming up with new personas for her. And so Denise Duhamel invented a whole bunch. And it's like, okay, that's a poetry book. Yeah. Not just a bunch of great poems, but a bunch of great poems that kind of build off each other. And I found myself laughing in different parts where it's like, I can't believe I'm reading a book of poems about Barbie. And the poems are so great.
I'm being moved.
And nobody should care about Barbie that much. I realize I haven't seen the new Barbie movie. I have every reason to believe it will not be dull.
I really enjoyed it.
I like the two screenwriters who are kind of borderline geniuses. They're certainly weirdos. So
the best kind of people.
I've been intrigued. But when there's a theme, it just solidifies in the memory. Like, oh, this is not just a collection of poems, but this is a book.
Yes. I think that's what I'm trying to get at least a little bit, is that, again, in the sense of, hey, family, read this. Not everyone loves poetry. Not everyone is searching that out, even if I think they should be, because I think poetry is great. In that sense, it's a book that I feel is not easy.
Well, and this is a book, right? I mean, we talked about the indeterminacy of the label.
Yes.
How are we going to classify this book? Prose poem? Yeah, that works. Lyric essay? Well, flash lyric essays, sure. And then you got the interstitial nature parts, which... neither of those categories work, right? So this is this fun hybrid of work. But for traditional readers, they're like, what is the context? How do we read it? It's like, well, this isn't the only book like this, but there aren't many. And it's relatively new. It's difficult for a traditional reader to get any sense of completion or enjoyment out of that experience. That's a lot to ask for.
Yeah. It's like, hey, do you want to go to this really beautiful river, and it has crystal clear water, and it stays 72 degrees all year round. There are definitely alligators in it, and they probably won't bother you, but you will see them, and they will be there. And there are otters that are maybe a little mean, and really big snapping turtles, but the water is really pretty. Do you want to go float down it in an inflatable float? And the answer is yes. Come with me on this adventure down a spring-fed river in Florida. It's going to be great. But that might be a hard sell if you've never floated down a spring-fed river in Florida before.
I was thinking more like, oh, do you want to go to this concert? Well, what kind of music is it? Well, not everyone thinks it's music, actually, but...
Buy my book. It's really good.
Which is to say, what Virginia Woolf would call a common reader. On the other hand, it's not like what you're doing is incomprehensible without those expectations either.
I hope that at least on the language level, the book is very easy to read, I think. I wanted to play with format and I wanted to play with the hybridity of it. And in that sense, I think it is kind of balanced with this very straightforward language. There aren't very many words that I think you'd have to look up, except maybe the title.
Definitely the title. But one of the things I found intriguing is the title of each piece, because the title of each piece is more or less a list of the characters who appear in the story.
Yes.
And labeled by their relationship to you. And I think that was the framing device that let me lock into each piece. It's like, okay, this is the information I have. And then you read the piece. Whereas I think if the titles were more extravagant or original, or okay, let me come up with a cleverer thing for all of these little pieces. Yeah, I feel like I might be struggling harder to remember, okay, and who is this person and who is that person? But instead, you know, this is a book that could be read in one sitting, but if you don't, yeah, okay, pick up this piece and it's like, all right, who? So I found, even though it's a very simple device of just, okay, each title is just going to be, who is this about? So fucking simple and so perfect.
It's also perfect because I hate titles. I mean, I love titles, but I hate titling things.
So that's something you share with Hemingway.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm always like, I don't know. It's a story about death, I guess. Let's call it Death. That's not a good title.
A Story About Death, I guess, actually would be a pretty great title.
Yeah. This is why I need your help, John. You can title things. I'll just tell you about them.
I might be better at titling things than actually writing things.
I think it's a different kind of skill, in the same way that writing a really good caption is a different kind of skill.
Maybe.
Or how spelling is not related to the other parts of language in our brain.
Is that a neurological fact?
Yes. It's housed in a different part.
Do tell. Or did you just tell everything you know?
That's more or less all the information I have about it.
Now that my eyesight is playing lots of games with me, I do find myself going, wait, is that spelled right or is that, oh no. The good news is I always spell Odyssey correctly.
And that's the only word that matters.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Misty Watkins, Michael Wheaton, Isaiah Portillo for editing this episode, the letter Q, and thank you for listening. If you want to write in with advice, comments, or thoughts, the email address is thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect, Heartbreaking Comic Book Reviews by Drew Barth, and reviews of cinematic masterpieces by our own curator of schlock, Jeff Schuster. Until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Never mind, John. Pass me the bottle.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Hi, this is John Waters, and you're listening to The Drunken Odyssey. Keep on listening, or I'll have you killed.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King. a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.